The Galileo quote, if you could read that for me as well. You might want to. Are you going to do any readings when you do your thing today?
No, I'm going to give a slide talk on the economics of the solar system.
Too bad. I'd love to hear you do some. Anyway,
I can send you the slides.
Yeah.
Philosophy is written in this grand book, I mean the universe, which stands continually open to our gaze, but it cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language in which it is written. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one is wandering about in a dark labyrinth.
What a noble passage. No, I would have thought that's from the Starry Messenger. I don't know what the assayer is.
Right. You got stuff from exposures in there, too. The assayer.
Yeah.
I think the assayer is part of the Starry Messenger, isn't it? But I've forgotten. Well, we can look it up.
Well, I've always thought the word starry is the most beautiful word in the language.
Yes.
I say that because my mother's maiden name was Starry. So there you go.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that beautiful?
That's actually a surname.
Yeah. Time shards.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go. And among several stories, it would seem that you're dealing with how do we deal with languages, how do we make connections with other cultures. Phonograph technology. You had me convinced that there really was something back in the past where we had actually heard sounds coming from an urn before.
Well,
you had me convinced of that. I think in the story somewhere you have him say that this had been done before.
That's right. He says so in the story, a story I wrote, I think, in 1979 for On Demand for Terry Carr, who called me up and said, look, I've got a hole in this anthology. I need something like 3,000 words long.
Well, aren't we glad that
and,
did.
And he called me on a Friday evening, and I wrote the story on Sunday and mailed it to him Monday. And I wrote it in one sitting because this idea had turned up in a paper in an engineering journal about attempting to do this.
Oh, really?
And at the time, the guy had not done it, but it has been done since, several times.
What can you tell me about what actually was done?
If you put a pot on a turning wheel and inscribe it with a very, very fine point, which was done many times through the history of pottery and crack pottery,
yeah,
it is possible to actually put the acoustic sounds in the environment into the joggle of that fine point and to inscribe it on a pot. And that has been heard. Mostly, as weirdly enough, I've said in the story, you could hear a horse in the background, because it occurred to me that would be a common thing, and it's loud enough, and it's regular enough. And in fact, we have heard such a thing on a pot. Mostly what you hear is the thumping of the turning wheel, because you see, you have to push, with a pedal. You push it with a pedal, and you can hear the pedal of the guy driving the pot.
But that's amazing, even if that's all it is,
right.
It's still.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Someone told me that there was a plot element stolen from this story for the X-Files, in which somehow they had a pot in which was described the sound of Jesus saying something to Lazarus. And therefore, if you could get the sound of this, it would be what Jesus said to raise Lazarus from the dead. So it was a method of restoring people to life. He told me about this show, but I haven't seen it. I was not a fan of X-Files. I don't like mystification much. But apparently it exists. And I was told by another guy in Hollywood that that's where they got the idea.
Well, Richard Matheson's story, The Traveler, takes us to the crucifixion. And so here you're taking us to a moment, perhaps, of the conversion to Christianity itself.
Something like that, yeah.
It's
kind of odd. Going back and visiting the crucifixion is now almost a cliche in SF. I thought the best treatment was Behold a Man by Mac Moorcock. Oh, it's really worth reading.
Okay, file it away.
Yeah.
Meantime.
Won a Nebula.
The ultimate irony about this is that one of the characters who's listening to this is just so dismissive. Well, we hear advice about sheep and all of this.
Yeah, right.
All of this renders it unuseful or illegitimate, or it just I mean, I don't care if it's a buying of a sheep. It's still history.
Right. You've got to realize that at every stage of human progress, there are always cynics and naysayers.
This guy is dismissing what he's hearing.
I mean, oh, sure, Newton. Yeah, but this is the apple falls, and that explains why the moon goes around. I don't think so. I don't see any connection there at all.
Don't you think that what people in the future are going to be interested in is really the desiderata of our language and our artifacts and all of that? They're not going to want to hear us declaim something profound. They want to know how we breathed and loved and lived. That's what this is.
Yes. You see, it's easy enough to get from ancient history a large series of brags. Because most of the great stuff inscribed by rulers is brags about how terrific they were. Ramesses, Ozymandias. I wrote a whole book about this, Deep Time, whose subtitle is How Humanity Communicates Across Millennia. And the short answer is mostly it doesn't, except accidentally. And only occasionally do time capsules and deliberate messages actually get through.
Well, Gregory, you have found a pot, and it looks like there's something on it. What do you hope would be on it if you could listen to it? What, maybe a moment in history or something?
If I could really go far back in this, I would like to hear Greek linear A spoken, because from that, if we could associate it with a text of something, would allow us to decipher linear A, which still is an unsolved problem. So I think I've got this right. Linear B we know how to read, but not linear A.
And we don't know what Greek music might have sounded like.
And we don't know how a Greek pronounced any of these words. We don't have oral information about language at all from the ancient world. We barely have a recording of Mark Twain speaking, and Christ, that was only a little over a century ago. I mean, you can hear his Missouri accent.
Well, supposedly somebody says that there's some kind of a recording technology of Chopin playing the minute waltz.
Oh, good. How long is it?
Good point.
Oh, sorry, that's the half-minute waltz. I got confused.
But all of these projects that are afoot to see, what did Brahms's voice sound like? How far back can we go to actually hear a sound from the past?
It's very hard. That's why I wrote Time Shards. Yeah. Terry said, I need this story, and I sat down and I wrote it on a manual typewriter, one draft, that's it. Because I like stories that run on their own melt, as the saying goes, to steal from Frost. I mean, when you get started, there's a reason that I really like writing is that you get in the zone and you just write. And people who talk about sweating out the words and Balzac quibbling over a comma for a day and all that is utterly the opposite of the way I write. Writing has always been a hobby of mine, which I do while I was also being a theoretical physicist and running a plasma physics lab and consulting and doing things like that, because it was fun and because you could sit down and do something complete, just let it flow right out of your head, and that's the kind of creation I like.
But then you revisit.
I revisit and do some rewriting. I actually do very little rewriting. Less than maybe 5 or 10% of the narrative.
Those of us who struggle at this hate you.
Well, I am spectacularly lazy. I talked to Heinlein about this. He has a parable of the lazy man who invented all these labor-saving devices because he just didn't care to do a lot of unnecessary work. Well, I was working and writing a great deal of stuff, including Timescape, on a manual typewriter, a really great Royal, which I still have with a Canterbury typeface. And I hated retyping. So sometimes I would write in triple space so that I could handwrite in stuff and still force it off on an editor who would have it retyped and set in type, just because I just didn't want to waste time retyping stuff. And the computer, the moment I saw a really good workable computer in 1979, I paid $10,000 to have a custom computer built so that I could use for calculations and word processing, which was, for over a decade, better than anything commercially available. It finally died on me.
Overworked.
It was written in CPM language, which I could write in, but CPM is extinct, like much other coding methods that I've used. Although Fortran, my first coding language, still works and is still used. It's the basis for MS-DOS and also for the software called Mathematica, which is the best general mathematical software. And you can still write in Fortran, in Mathematica.
Well, I find it odd to run across writers who seem to boast about the fact that they only write in longhand. It's like a jazz musician boasting that he can't read music. Is that something to boast about?
Well, I don't really care much about whether people write in longhand or not. Joe Haldeman does, and each day it's in a different color of ink, so he can tell how many words he wrote. That's an artifact, by the way, of his devotion to Hemingway, who literally counted the words he wrote every day, you know, which is goes, you know, that's super anal. Whereas I will typically look at how many words I wrote in a day just so I have roughly an idea, but that's done by a machine. It would never occur to me to count words. On the other hand, the easiest way to tell an amateur from a pro in writing is if when you say, how long is this thing you wrote, they give it to you in pages instead of words.
But if I show that to somebody, how long did it take you? How long did it take you to paint it? That's the only reaction I usually get about any painting I do.
I never ask that.
How many words did you write?
Right.
But for somebody to boast about the fact that they don't read music, to boast about
That's odd.
Right. How many jazz musicians have we heard say that? One, I don't believe them. And two, I think it's an incredibly self-limiting thing to say.
Paul McCartney said that he only learned to write music when they were in the middle period, right around Revolver and Eleanor Rigby, when he started to work with that string quartet he famously brought in to do the background passages, because then he had to talk to them about, you know, this should be in C minor and so on. But that John Lennon never learned to read music. But, you know, I learned to read music and have forgotten.
But you would think you'd want to embrace.
Yeah. If I was composing, I would relearn music, how to write music.
Now, I'm going to switch gears. I came to armed with this very tiny quote from Exposures. I do not believe, but there is a communion.
Yes.
Are you into a kind of a Gnostic gospel thing here?
Well, yes, I'm an Episcopalian. So.
Well, that's clear from some of your characters.
And I was an acolyte in the church when I was 12 and 13. And I always assisted in the communion service. And therefore, you know, I got to schlep out the wafers and then the wine. And the problem is that it was in the old days when the acolytes wore the full robes. And it was July in Atlanta with no air conditioning in the church. And you were always in danger of passing out. So it made it a spiritual experience almost against your will. You were very barely holding on to consciousness. And so it actually has a kind of hallucinogenic effect on you when you're trying to get through the service. Thank God we didn't drink too much of this wine.
This is a pun on the word communion.
Yes, of course.
I mean, it's not just a churchly ritual, but communion as an interaction of some kind, I guess.
Right. So, well, astronomy has a form of communion with the infinite. That's what Exposures is about. Everyone's had the spiritual experience of gazing into the night sky and saying, good Lord, look at that.
When they can find a night sky with stars.
If you can, yes. It is. Although in Kansas, you get out away from the city lights, you're fine.
Well, I was in Montana recently this summer. Oh, my God. It was like I'd never seen the sky before, even though I grew up in the Midwest.
Well, it's one reason I have a place in the High Sierras. I spend the summer there, and you can see the entire plane of the galaxy. Walking among the trees.
But I do not believe, but there is a communion. Is this almost a kind of a credo for you?
Yes, there is. I believe.
You're not a religious person, more.
Not overtly religious, but there's a difference between spiritual and religious. But there is a spiritual sense that humans have, and I think it comes from being deeply embedded in our evolutionary progression, because remember, we're the only branch of the primates that actually got out of Africa and spread over the whole planet. The other forms of the higher apes that we're with never got anywhere, except the orangutans managed to get to Madagascar, I think, or maybe beyond. And we did so very rapidly. We now know of new forms of early humans, like the Denisovians, or this latest discovery in South Africa, or the ones near New Guinea, that we had many different forms, and we obviously evolved very, very quickly in our perception of the world and spread through it, and we picked up a whole lot of skills, and you can see it in our local adaptations now. We're the only one remaining. All our competitors are eliminated, the most recent, apparently, the Neanderthals. And there are vestigial little signs of local adaptations, what we call the races, the Mongolians, the Caucasians, and the Negroids. But these are tiny little differences in skin color and nose size and the folds of the eyelids, really just cosmetic changes. Nonetheless, those are local adaptations to the world. And so we are deeply rooted in the world individually.
I think Harold Bloom has a new book out where he talks about the American sublime, where the sublime is within, it's not without.
Yes, right.
The humanism is the sublime.
Humanism. But the modern sense is to merge that sublime with the technological sublime. So the perspectives of the universe you get from telescope give you the technological sublime. Or there is the sublime nature of just the technology itself. And here the rocket is the technological sublime for the expansion of human horizons now, which 500 years ago was a sailing ship.
It's a McLuhan-esque medium that extends our...
Yeah. It's a technology that extends the human grasp.
Okay. If I could take maybe another 10 minutes. Sure. You've been so generous. That leads us to the voice. Now, the big read is set for the spring here in the Midwest, and it's going to be Fahrenheit 451.
Again? Boy, L.A. did that 8 years.
We're catching up. Not my favorite book, by the way, but that's off the record.
Now, have you done True Grit?
No.
That's a really good book. It was the read in Mammoth, California this last summer. I read it. It's really terrifically good. The great voice of the late 19th century.
Well, what I'm getting at with this is, in the big read, Michael Dirt is coming in, and I'm going to do some stuff, and they want me to talk about Fahrenheit 451 in whatever direction I'd like to take it. So I come across The Voice just a few days ago. Well, Centigrade 233. Talk to me about The Voice. This is an acoustic, McLuhan-esque acoustic world these people are living in.
Yes. I first wrote in a tribute volume to Ray Bradbury, my story Centigrade 233, which is the same temperature, which is set in a future rapidly approaching in which people don't read in physical books much anymore. And so it's a satirical take on that. Ray liked the story, he told me, actually. It was in a tribute anthology, and I was doing a signing with him and one other person who was in the anthology. I've forgotten who that was. Maybe Harry Turtledove, and he sat next to me and said, you know, I just read your story. It was really terrific. It really knocked me off my pins, or something like that, because it's a satirical look at what might happen. The flip side of that, though, is that the digital revolution now plainly has allowed many more books to be published. There are more books in print now than there have ever been, by a factor of several. I mean, the number of books issued per year in English has gone up by a factor of about 3 in the last decade. It really is not going away. And that's because you can self-publish. And so I've been able to take several of my novels that I got back from New York publishers, put them back into print, and keep 85% of the money. It only costs 15% of it to sell it to someone and make it.
Well, you describe the narrow age of literacy.
Right.
Quote, a time of constrained modes, hopelessly linear and slow. People were divided by their access to information.
Yes, that's right. everybody talks about, you know, being able to read opens up the whole universe, which is true. But we now have a lot of people who read but not well, who can understand street signs but not Shakespeare. And that mode in which visual information comes at you so fast can, in a way, easily triumph over the linear word and sentences. After all, that's what movies do. Look at it this way. You can look at all the paintings of Vermeer, which I have in person. I've seen every one in person.
Even the one in Buckingham Palace?
No, you're right. Touche. I saw that in a print. I haven't seen the one. Wasn't that a great movie?
Absolutely. My favorite movie.
Tim's Vermeer. God, unbelievably good. But you can see all of his work in an hour, easily enough, in prints. But try digesting all of Faulkner's work. You can't do it in a month.
Not sure I'd want to be.
Well, I'm a Faulkner fan, but I haven't read everything because there's a great deal. So there is a place for visual information, and I just want to satirize it, particularly in The Voice. The Voice just came to me as out of nowhere, and I sat down and realized it was an intersection of Bradbury and I think Asimov's to some extent. I've forgotten actually what I was thinking of when I was writing it, but to think of a future in which writing was the secret language and it was used by the underground, because if you know much about the Zamazats in the Soviet Union, that was the underground. It was actually carbon paper made fanzines, basically. I took that to mind because the first fanzine my brother and I ever published, called Vacuum, was done with carbon paper, just the way they did it with Zamazats in the Soviet Union. You know, it was a capital crime to own a mimeograph in the Soviet Union in the Stalin years? A capital crime.
Stop and think about it. I guess you can understand why it would be.
And typewriters had to be licensed. You had to get a permit to buy one. When I was in the Soviet Union in 1984, I noticed that a sure sign that the regime was starting to crumble was that there were not one, but two padlocks on each Xerox machine in a national laboratory. You had to go to two people to get it unlocked and make a Xerox copy. Those little visual cues, which I wrote it in my report to the CIA, are really telling. Nobody remarks on it. It's just there's some padlocks over here on the Xerox machine. Isn't that odd? Well, it's not odd to them. That's the point.
Well, you write about this growing independence from linear print slavery.
Yes.
Do you think this is happening?
Some people regard reading as an encumbrance. No, that's obviously true. Look at the people who don't read the textbooks among undergraduates. I hear this all the time at UC Irvine. You can assign the text, but you can't force their eyes over it. And oddly enough, the texts have gotten longer and longer, so that they're heavier and heavier and cost more. And the revolt against that is two-pronged. One is to, A, not read it, or just go through enough in order to solve the problems. You see that all the time in physics classes. They won't actually read the chapter. They'll just go, well, I got to do this, so here's this piece. I'll read that and see if I can take it out, which is a very bad way to try to learn physics. Right. And the second method is to simply put all the books into a Kindle edition, which has happened.
I know, me too. I've never revisited one to look. Okay,